You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Tonight's show is about creativity and mental health, mental illness, the brain, bipolar disorder, and creativity. You know, there's been a lot of speculation on the intersection of the creative life and bipolar disorder, but also other mental illnesses. And there's some concern that that we don't really know what's going on, but we're starting to find out more. There's more neural imaging and more studies. I was reading up on it this week, and there's more studies coming to the front saying that there is a connection, but it's not as simple as we thought it once was. But today we're going to explore that, and we're going to talk to, we have a couple of in-studio guests. We're going to be talking about a young man named Sean Costello, who was a local musician done well. He recorded with Sue Tedeschi. He recorded with a bunch of people. Great blues guitarist.
Levon Helm. The Alabama Boys?
Yeah. Blind Boys of Alabama,
yeah.
And a lot of great people. And he...
Hubert Sumlin,
who was Howlin' Wolf's guitarist. And he was a fantastic guitarist. He suffered from bipolar disorder, and he passed away right before his 29th birthday. In the studio are is Debbie Costello Smith, Sean's mother, and she's the founder and past president and board member emeritus of the Sean Costello Memorial Fund. She's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and Wharton School of Business and has extensive experience in healthcare administration and hospitals, HMOs, the insurance industry, healthcare contracting and managed care. And Glenn Smith, who is Sean's stepfather, is the president of the Sean Costello Memorial Fund for Bipolar Research. He's got extensive experience in healthcare sales at the corporate level and was a partner in U.S. Health Connections. But his fondest job of all was part-time road manager for the Sean Costello Band when Sean was too young to travel on his own. I want to hear some of those stories. He is the consummate biographer of Sean's career. And joining us on the phone all the way from down under in Australia is Professor Greg Murray, who's an academic clinical psychologist professor at Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, Australia. And he's the scientific committee chair of the Sean Costello Memorial Fund for Bipolar Research. He's published over 100 peer-reviewed articles and chapters, won individual awards for teaching and research, and been a chief investigator on more than $5 million of grants in Australia and overseas. Greg has a parallel life as a drummer, as some of us in the studio have a parallel lives as drummers. And Greg can be seen around Melbourne with the band The Ambassadors of Love. Welcome to Right Turn Radio, the Smiths, Debbie Costello Smith, Glenn Smith, and Professor Greg Murray.
Glenn, are you with us?
Yes. Thanks for the welcome.
Glenn, where are you now? I'm sorry, Greg, where are you right now?
Well, I'm actually in Alberta, Canada.
Okay, terrific.
In a little town called Canmore. Coincidentally, we've just had a meeting of the research group I'm involved with here in Canada, which is a group that specializes in looking at psychosocial issues in bipolar disorder. And our meeting was here this week, so it meant I was pretty much in your time zone, which is better than ringing you at 4 o'clock in the morning my time.
Sure, absolutely.
So Greg, can we get a little background about the idea before we jump into Sean's story? Of your kind of idea of where the intersection is between creativity and bipolar disorder.
Yeah, so really, as you mentioned in your very clear introduction, it's a long-standing idea, and so it's often assumed that there's this link between serious mental disorder and creativity, and myself and some other colleagues a few years ago decided to sort of check it out to see if in fact there was any data to support that. And as you also mentioned, it's not as clear cut as we might think. But we, in the big review we conducted, which we published a couple of years ago now, we did conclude that there definitely is an association between bipolar disorder and creativity. It's not perhaps as strong as you might think. So we can quantify it a bit, and I think it's useful to quantify. So there is an association, but there's a way of sort of measuring how big that association is. In the general population, the prevalence of bipolar disorder is about 1%. About 1 in 100 people would warrant the diagnosis of bipolar disorder type 1, which is the sort of classical bipolar disorder. But in a study which reviewed the biographies of more than 1,000 eminent artists, what they found was the prevalence of bipolar disorder in that group was something like 6.5%. So that's an enormous, you know, a 6.5 times increase of the prevalence of bipolar disorder in a sample of eminent artists. But of course, it's also nowhere near 100%, right? So there is an association, a six-fold increase in prevalence is a very significant association scientifically. But of course, it doesn't mean that all creative people have bipolar disorder, and it doesn't mean that all people with bipolar disorder are creative.
Okay.
Though it is interesting to note, we've subsequently done more research into this, and in terms of people with bipolar disorder, they do often report valuing creativity. Now, whether they're successful at it or, you know, they turn it into their career or not is another question. But it is a very important value of theirs, and that has important implications for how psychologists and psychiatrists and other health professionals engage with people with bipolar disorder. You know, if that's one of their values, then we need to factor it in everything we do.
Mm-hmm. You know, Greg, I recently read a book called The Da Vinci Method, where they identified the DRD4 dopamine gene.
Yep.
Which they're trying to link to the creative-minded thinking person.
Yep. That's not surprising. So if we think there is an association, well, there is. I think we can conclude that there is an association between bipolar disorder and creativity. Then the next question becomes, what's the mechanism? How does that association exist? And we've always thought that there are a couple of possible mechanisms. We're not sure, but both of them kind of involve dopamine. So the two mechanisms that we think might be involved in bipolar disorder, linking it to creativity, is people with bipolar disorder, when they're not too ill, obviously when you're, you know, full-blown manic, you're not doing anything constructive, really. But when you're in the milder sort of foothills of mania, or when it's just your temperament showing itself, then you have access to positive mood states. So people with bipolar disorder are really very unusual when it comes to mental disorders in that they have access to positive mood states. And we know from other research that has been really quite comprehensively pursued that there is a strong association between positive mood states and creative thinking. So if you want to get someone in a creative frame of mind, make them happy.
Mm-hmm, right.
If you want to close down someone's thinking, make them sad. We've known that for a long time, or make them anxious. We've known that for a long time. So that's one of the mechanisms. And dopamine is a critical pathway in that happiness, positive affect, sort of engagement sort of process.
So now,
I'm
sorry. So what you're describing, and thank you for the really good background on bipolar disorder, which some of our audience might know as what used to be called manic depression. I understand, just from speaking with people with bipolar 1 and 2, sometimes people in hypomania, mm-hmm. which you'd be able to describe better than I, you know, kind of have these bursts of creativity that they describe, and they describe the state of hypomania and mania as being empowering to them. And like you said, when it's full-blown mania, that's probably not the most constructive period of the cycle for them. But the people that I've spoken to that have, you know, that have been diagnosed with bipolar 2, many of them our musicians and talk about that time when they feel hyper creative. They can feel their neurons just flaming up and they're able to do that stuff. Does that sound like we're going down the right path?
Undoubtedly. Yeah, no, there's no doubt. In fact, the same sort of finding that you've just sort of outlined, or the same association between the extent of mania, you know, when we get too excited, we're really out for lunch and we're not doing anyone any good. But in those milder states, which people with bipolar disorder can experience, there's no doubt, and they're not just feeling creative, they often actually are.
Greg, I gotta break in for, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to meet Debbie Costello-Smith and Glenn Smith from the Sean Costello Memorial Fund to talk about creativity and bipolar disorder. We'll be right back after the break.
Hi, welcome back to Right Turn Radio. My name is Woody Giesman. I'm here with John Cohan. I want to remind you all to like us on Facebook and also look for our tweets.
Look for our tweets.
Yes.
Tonight we're talking, that, by the way, bringing us back in from the break, that was Sean Costello on guitar, lovely guitar player. Tonight in our studio we're talking about creativity and bipolar disorder. And we're joined in the studio by Debbie Costello Smith and Glenn Smith, Sean's mom and stepdad, and they're with the Sean Costello Fund, named after Sean. And on the phone we have Professor Greg Murray, who is the scientific committee chair of the Sean Costello Fund. So we got some background on bipolar disorder and creativity. I want to ask you guys to tell us about Sean and who he was and a little about his life and his creativity and why you created this fund.
Okay. Sean was very funny from when he was born, from an infant. Very funny, very bright. And when he was three, he wanted to play a fiddle. And that's what he wanted. We lived in New Jersey, and not too many fiddles were hanging around. And too young for Suzuki. And so when he was about seven, I think he got his first guitar. It was, you know, just an acoustic guitar. And then he never put that guitar down. The other part of him was that he was always very, very shy, had a lot of social anxiety, mm-hmm. Had a hard time making eye contact, for example. He met Glenn when he was just almost six. And I asked him to tell Glenn his name, and he could barely whisper his name. But at the same time, in third grade, he came home and he said, we lived in New Jersey outside of Camden. He went to a magnet school there. And he came home, he said, "Mom, I'm going to be in a play." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Who are you going to be?" He said, "Martin Luther King." And Shaw is very blonde. And I said, "Well, don't be surprised if you don't get that part, you know, because you're not exactly, you know, type yet." And he said, but he got the part because he was the only kid, I think, that could memorize the speech. But at the same time, he researched him, and he had his voice to the point where I said, you know, you got to back off a little bit because you sound like you're mimicking. And he would only wear a yellow tie because they didn't wear pink ties in 1963. Mm-hmm. And I went to the school totally prepared to be embarrassed by this child who stood up and whispered. And he brought people to their feet.
So early on, he had an affinity for performance.
He performed he performed at home all the time. He would slide into the kitchen and be Michael Jackson, you know, cut the fingers off of my gloves because he wanted to be Michael Jackson. And so, yeah, he was always, and at the same time, it was this dichotomy between being like really shy and quiet and being able to perform.
Now, he kept that shyness in social situations around the house as well, or?
Or people that he knew. Sean was actually very talkative, and he was hysterically funny. I mean, he could be a stand-up comedian. He was very, very quick, very witty. He had a laugh that if you were in another room, you would laugh just because he was laughing. And so, you know, he's very entertaining. I keep trying to get the people that he toured with to write a book just about Sean because of the things he would say. I mean, he's just very funny. But in a group of people he didn't know.
He was, you know, shy still. He experienced, he showed some talent towards learning and performing. When did he become, you know, a blues guitarist? When did he really, when did he take on that
the blues,
that style? Yeah.
Well, he started actually with, we were, I was telling Woody, we had taken him to a Cinderella concert where he was the youngest person there and we were the oldest people
there.
That's
not a blues band.
No, no, no. That's what I'm saying. But that's where he started. No, I mean, he started in, you know, AC/DC, you know, and Cinderella and Motley Crue and all that. And then he just found Jimi Hendrix. And he never got off of Jimmy. We heard Hey Joe like all day, every day. But Glenn, you have the story about how he got into blues. Because you were there.
Yeah, we, interesting story. He was, we were going to a guitar show, and we're walking around, and he walked up to the Rickenbacker guy, and he said to the guy, he said, could I try one of your guitars? And the guy said, listen, I'm sorry, kid. You know, these are adult guitars. This is not made for, you know, children.
He was very small, too.
So he said, okay. And we, and across the hall, across the booth there, across the walkway, was the Gibson guy. And he walked over to the Gibson guy, and he said, can I play a gold top? Do you have a gold top I could play? And the guy said, can you play the guitar? And he said, yeah, I can play, you know. And he said, well, what kind of amp do you want? He said, well, do you have a bass man or a dual?
Right.
He said, yeah, I have a dual. So he hooked him up, and he started to play. Well, this huge crowd gathered around him because he started out with manic depression, okay, and went from there, and he played for about a half hour, and the people applauded. And in the audience was a guy named Felix Reyes, and he had a band called Felix and the Cats. He's originally from Texas and was in Atlanta. And when we got done playing, he walked over, and the guy from Rickenbach came down to him and said, here, would you like to play my guitar? And Sean said, no, thank you, I've already played.
So, I've got an endorsement from Gibson now.
So we went outside, and this guy, Felix, comes running out. And he said, listen, he said, do you know, do you like blues? And he said, yeah, I like some blues. He said, I'm going to give you some records. And he gave him a lot of old blues records, you know, 78s. And he said, I'm playing at this place called, what's it called?
Red Hot and Blue.
Red Hot and Blue. He said, on New Year's Eve. He said, would you like to come and play with me?
So
wow.
So, and his band ended up being Sean's
band. And so how
band.
Old is he at this point?
12.
Yeah.
12. Okay, wow.
Yeah.
Now, well, and what an amazing young man. Very, you know, and we encourage anyone to go to the Sean Costello website and look at his discography. Let me ask a question here. At what point did you begin to see these symptoms consistent with bipolar disorder?
I didn't know that it was bipolar disorder. I'm embarrassed to say. My brother is a psychologist. I'm actually a nurse with a master's degree. I didn't know anything about bipolar disorder. I did know that he was very shy, like, and that he would come and say, Mom, I'm sad. Why am I so sad? So when he was about 12, he actually got into a situation with some kids where he was drinking. And I have alcoholism in the family. I've done actually some work is in an alcohol rehab center, and so I started him right away in counseling. And I got this, and Greg can probably talk to this bipolar type 2 issue. I just got all the time, like I had Munchausen's by proxy, because he was handsome and adorable and articulate and funny. And they just told me that he was just a normal kid. All kids do this kind of stuff.
Right.
And then he was seen a psychiatrist. He was given Prozac for a depression. He had a manic symptom. He tried to go out a third-story window to get an paper airplane. I took him off the Prozac. I called the psychiatrist, and I said, you know, the indications say that this could be, at the time, manic depression. And he said, oh, Sean's not manic depressive.
Mm.
And so this continued on until he was about 27 years old.
Greg, does any of this sound familiar? Is bipolar disorder ever misdiagnosed or missed by...
It's extremely common.
Yeah.
It's extremely common, and it's typically misdiagnosed as unipolar depression, that is common or garden depression, which is a very common presenting problem. So we now know that it's very important that if anyone turns up to their psychologist or their doctor or their counsellor complaining of depression, pretty much question number one has to be probing for any evidence of extroversion or, you know, showing off or that, you know, sort of hyper temperament that we know really does make us start to think that this person might be on the bipolar spectrum.
Absolutely, Greg.
Risk.
So, Greg, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'd like to talk more about your experience with your research with bipolar disorder. Also, Deb and Greg Costello-Smith about their son, Sean Costello. And I'd kind of like to turn the corner here a little bit and start to talk about people with bipolar disorder and how or why they are at high risk for substance use. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Right Turn Radio. My name is Woody Giesman. I'm here with John Cohan. That was a little bit of blues music for you.
Yeah, that's Sean Costello playing Double Trouble. What a wonderful voice. I liked his guitar playing. It was unique. It wasn't like cookie
very
cutter.
Rich.
Yeah, very rich. And there's a depth of feeling there, which kind of brings us, you know, to what we're talking about. You were talking about, Woody asked you when the symptoms of the bipolar disorder showed up. So when did he finally become diagnosed with?
He was around age 27.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what happened was he was a Kaiser and he had to fill out this form. But then he told me they wanted me to fill out a form as well. And I think that's really what made the difference in terms of his diagnosis, is having someone from the outside reflecting what
yes.
they saw. And so I really didn't know what that meant. And, I don't think he necessarily knew what that meant. It kind of scared him a little bit. And then by this time, he was heavy into alcohol. And, of course, the flip side of that is coke, right? So
mm-hmm.
They were his two main issues. And then he decided when he was 28, right before his, you know, birthday, it was the week before his birthday, he finally decided to enter rehab. He just wanted to get better. And he said to me over and over again, Mom, how come other people can feel better and I can't? And so, you know, it was just something he carried around with him forever. He was an old soul. You know, he was very, very sensitive. He was very sweet. But as Greg can tell you, I mean, this connection between alcohol and bipolar disorder, I think what I've heard is there's about a 50% connection of people who have bipolar disorder and have an alcohol dependence.
Well, let's go to Greg. Greg, hi, it's Woody. And, you know, I kind of wanted to throw this out there because we have, you know, a creative musician type person who's quite possibly at high risk for being around mm-hmm. substances just by nature. And now we also have someone who has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So can we talk about the high risks for substance use disorder by someone like Sean Costello?
Yeah. Look, it's a great question, and there are lots of ways that risk sort of makes sense to us. You know, as we know, being a performer, it's one of the few professions where alcohol is freely available in the workplace. So there are situational factors. You know, everyone else is drinking. The whole, you know, the party atmosphere, especially around certain forms of music, the blues being one of them. You know, what do we go and see a blues band for? Part of it is to let our hair down. And it just so happens the people working in that industry are exposed to the same sorts of social expectations. So there's that contextual risk factor. But the other thing, we've already mentioned a couple of things. There's this very strong link between anxiety and bipolar disorder. And alcohol is a wonderful, seriously problematic, but it's a very attractive treatment for anxiety problems. It calms us down and makes us feel more self-confident. So that's another major sort of factor that might make that link. And then another one is obviously sometimes when we're in sort of hyper states and feeling very creative, the alcohol can enhance that state. So we do see people reaching out for alcohol as a way of magnifying that sort of experience of, you know, flying, of feeling disconnected from the everyday. So there's all sorts of reasons that would underpin this very strong association between substance use problems and bipolar disorder. And
so, you know, I mean,
that's a common presentation.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting, you know, and as a musician, I traveled many years and I was around many different musicians, and everyone kind of had their reputation of, oh, wow, if you want to see a really good show, these guys like this substance, you know. Mm. So people would show up with whatever substance that they were most known for, you know.
Well, that happened to Sean from what I heard, is that people will come up and try to offer them
Can you tell us a little bit more about that, please?
Well, what I've heard after the fact is that people will come up to Sean and they, like, he was, you know, trying to lay off Coke or whatever, and they'd come up and offer it to him, and his friends would be like, you know, no, back off, leave him alone, you know, don't do this to him.
Right.
But, you know, they wanted to be his buddy, they wanted to be his pal, they wanted him to like him, so, you know, they gave it to him for free. I did want to just mention about that anxiety piece that Greg talked about. Sean had horrible anxiety, he had issues with panic attacks, and he felt very frustrated, and I don't know, Greg, whether you can talk to this or not, but he felt very frustrated because when we went to the physicians, they wouldn't give him anything for that anxiety, because those substances tend to be abused.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, there aren't really good medications for anxiety, which is why people these days, so the anti-anxiety medications are one of the subset of sort of psychiatric medications, which we know are seriously problematic in terms of addiction and tolerance. That is, people need to use more and more of them. They just don't work very well.
No.
Which is why for anxiety problems these days, people are often prescribed antidepressants, right? Because antidepressant medication has some of the different types of antidepressants have some benefits for anxiety. But of course, the problem with that is people who are on the bipolar spectrum can have a problematic response to those antidepressants.
That's right.
So it does make a complicated problem in terms of management. But yeah, there is no simple pharmacological treatment for anxiety. What we do know is if you have anxiety problems, you really need psychological treatments for that.
Now, is it possible, Greg, or I'll throw this out to the Smiths as well, is it possible that some of the characteristics and symptoms of his substance use and abuse were masking a possible diagnosis of the bipolar disorder?
Well, he was self-medicating.
So people do use the alcohol to, you know, try and control the highs and control the anxiety that is so strongly connected to the condition. So yeah, you can progress through life with an alcohol problem that means that you don't so much get noticed for your mood problem. And I noticed in your promo for this show, you talk about that bi-directional relationship between depression and substance abuse, which is so right. That it's a vicious cycle, isn't it, of mood problems and alcohol use. And we see that a lot, especially in bipolar 2, which is that milder, well, the manic states of bipolar 2 aren't as extreme, but the depression is particularly heavy.
Right.
Bipolar 2 is a very depressive problem, primarily a problem with depression that does not respond well to antidepressant medication.
Then that was Sean. Sean definitely was bipolar type 2 with, and so when he was hypomanic, I just thought he was happy.
Right,
I was like, oh, he's in a good mood, you know, he's happy, he's
and
doing okay.
And it's a relief to us, isn't it? And it's a relief to the person themselves to be out of that depressive phase, which they might have been in for months and months and months, which is why, you know, if we're helping people with bipolar 2 especially, we need to appreciate how attractive those hypomanic states are. It's like, oh my God, finally I'm feeling like myself. And so we really have to make sure we don't pathologize those excited states, because then the person with the disorder just says, whoa, you don't understand me. You don't understand the life I'm living. If you want me to calm down, you're not understanding what I've been through for the last 12 months or how I see myself.
Yeah, and I think the medication comes up then too, because Sean was on Depakote at one time and he came home. He said, Mom, it's like walking through butterscotch. I cannot perform on this medication, and perform is what I do for a living.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We hear that a lot from people who, and you know, it's an art to, like, get the proper medication for these symptoms.
Well, yeah, but then I have the same concern. We talked about it a little bit before the show, and Greg, maybe you can jump in on this, that, you know, I ask, well, were people seeing your son, Sean Costello, and thinking, wow, he's just depressed, and giving him antidepressants, and you know, what's going to happen when you give someone with bipolar disorder an antidepressant?
It's going to go out the third floor window and chase a paper airplane.
you told the story of when he was put on Prozac.
Well, Prozac, yeah. And I called the psychiatrist and said, doesn't this indicate that he might be manic? And he said no.
So, we're starting to get a bigger picture of this. And we're starting to see that, like Greg says, there is an intersection here between this bipolar disorders and creativity. We're going to talk more about it when we come back after a break, but we're also going to learn more about the Sean Costello Memorial Fund and what the work you guys are doing, what Professor Greg Murray is doing, and the research that's happening when we come back to Right Turn Radio right after this break. I want to know more about the Sean Costello Fund. How did you create it, and what work do you guys do?
I actually did it in Sean's obituary because so many people did not. Well, a lot of people didn't even know Sean had a problem because he was so professional, mm-hmm. you know. But the other thing was, I mean, he had been in counseling all that time, and I was relatively well versed in alcohol and, you know, mental health. Excuse me. It just seemed to me like if this happened to him, what's happening to everybody else? Something just intuitively seemed wrong. That was part of it. The other part of it is Sean was not proud of what he did. LaVon Helm did an interview and he said Sean was not about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which a lot of people think, you know. He was in treatment at the time. He was seriously trying to feel better and get better. And I thought it was, you know, I was trying to protect his reputation to some extent, to explain, but also to try to find out what's wrong, what was going wrong. I'm a scientist at heart, and so it is the Sean Costello Memorial Fund. Technically, it's called the Sean Costello Memorial Fund to benefit bipolar research.
Well, Glenn, you said he was self-medicating.
Yeah, well, what would happen, you know, to make himself feel better, occasionally we get on a medication and he'd start to feel good, and when he felt good, he'd stop taking the medication, which is a big problem. And then when he didn't feel good again, he would start to drink.
Yeah.
And when the drink wasn't effective, then he'd do a little Coke.
Yeah.
And he was in an environment where he'd go out to play a concert and he'd have $150 or $200 bar tab, and he'd have 50 girls waiting in line with eight balls for him.
Yeah.
You know, and he's 25 years old, 24 years old. They don't leave an empty. They don't leave anything on the bar tab when they're done playing. Mm. I can assure you that.
So, you know, here's this young gentleman, incredibly talented, troubled,
yes,
but successful.
Yes,
yeah,
very high functioning.
I can you talk about how the end came and you said he got a diagnosis fairly late in life.
Right. It was about 15 years into the mental health system, which the statistics show, and correct me, Greg, if I'm wrong, it takes about 8 to 10 years to diagnose bipolar disorder. So that initial early diagnosis is really important because it is very common that people will self-medicate, I mean, to survive those high highs and those low lows. Sean was in a program. It was an outpatient program, but he was in an inpatient detox for 3 days. At the end of the 3 days, they drove him to a bar to play, and then they didn't give him his medication. Anyway, so he was there. On Friday, he was manic. I called them. I said, he's manic. You know, what are you going to do? They said they would take care of it, and they didn't. They told him he needed to grow up and do it on his own. So he left. He was living with us and his support system, you know. And so he went. He said, Mom, I have to grow up and do this on my own. Mm-hmm. And so he went and stayed wherever. We didn't know where he was. And so on Monday night, he was supposed to go to an AA meeting with another musician, and he just said, I can't go. I haven't slept in days. And he apparently died of an overdose of heroin. Wow. But they had also put him on Librium, and so he had Librium in his system as well.
Well, Greg, I want to pull you into this conversation, and I'd like to hear from you about when you began to connect with the mission of the Sean Costello Foundation.
So it was a few years ago now when a colleague of mine, Sherry Johnson, who's a very well-known professor from University of California in Berkeley, and she's probably the world's leader in looking at bipolar disorder from a psychological perspective, which is a really relatively new thing. You know, even in this conversation today, we've been talking a lot about medications for bipolar disorder, and we haven't spoken much about, you know, what's the best form of counselling or psychological or behavioural therapy. So it's all relatively new. And Sherry was, in fact, the inaugural chair of the scientific committee of the Sean Costello Fund. And when her workload got a bit too much, and she and I had been doing quite a few things together, including looking at this creativity link, she asked me if I would be interested in stepping into that role for her, because she was just unable to continue with it in her very senior positions that she's taking on at the moment. And so I was very excited to start to get involved. And the particular idea that I think really connected myself and Deb was starting to really think about, if you are going to engage people with bipolar disorder who are creative, how you need to very much pitch your story to them in a way that makes sense to them. So you've heard me say a few times in this conversation about the importance of paying full respect to people's desire to be creative.
Yes.
And people's enjoyment of those hypomanic states.
There it is.
You're singing our song.
And that actually is the other reason why I started it, because when Sean was in this therapy, I thought, this is like putting a square peg in a round hole.
Well, I think I just want to get briefly from you, Greg, an understanding of the type of research you guys are doing for under the auspices of the fund.
Yep. So we're doing all sorts of, but perhaps the thing that captures best our work with the fund is how we think about that interface between the creative lifestyle and psychological therapies. So we started out, you know, because of my background in music, and I know a lot of people who are performers and have this sort of temperament, a lot of people with bipolar disorder diagnoses in my own life, and of course in my clinical work. It struck me that the way we normally talk about psychological therapies is sort of pretty offensive to people from the creative side of the fence, because the sort of aesthetic or the sort of culture that we bring as psychologists and counsellors is sort of this, let's get you back to work. Let's get you on a 9-to-5 schedule. Let's get you da-da-da-da-da. And I realised very quickly that my patients with bipolar disorder and my friends with the diagnosis would say, well, I don't want to get back to work. That sounds like the rat race to me.
You know, so Greg, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, and I love the word engagement that you used before. You know, off the air, we were talking about a young man who just celebrated 2 years of sobriety in our clinic, but prior to that, we spent 6 months just asking if he were ready to have a conversation about getting well. So it's really about engagement.
It really is about engagement. This is such a huge topic. I think we need to do another show. We need to get the Costello Smiths back in here, Professor Greg Murray. We need you back on the show, and we need to discuss this more, because this is, for what we do, substance abuse treatment, we see this all the time. I'd like to thank the Costello Smiths.
Can I do one quick promo?
Yes.
Sean's being inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame in October.
All right.
That's a beautiful thing. www.seancostellofund.org. Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.